둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Welcome to the In Defense of Ska podcast.
There's a lot of like, okay, well, you like ska, name three bands that aren't the Boss Tones.
I'm your host, Aaron Carnes, music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska.
And I'm your co-host, Adam Davis, veteran ska musician from the bands Omnigon and Link 8.
On our show, we aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of ska music.
There are so many great untold stories throughout the history of ska. The show features interviews with everyone from the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones to Fishbone, Fall Out Boy singer Patrick Stump, and the Police drummer Stuart Copeland. Join us on In Defense of Ska from the Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
Back in the basement. Yeah.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, and welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org. Consequence and the Consequence Podcast Network. Thanks as always for making your way here, for checking out the episode. Do hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all the interviews that I put out every single week. New and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Makes a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover the new ones. You can grab us anywhere you get podcasts from. Spotify, Apple Podcast, NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from. You can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. Don't forget to give the show a rating. Leave a review if you feel so inspired. That always helps out so much. We've had some great guests on lately, including comedian Joe Gatto from Impractical Jokers, David Miller from Il Divo, Grace Cummings was here, Sebastian Bach, Amber Sharday Robinson, she stars in Palm Royale on Apple TV+, Prentice Penny, he produced Black Twitter, A People's History on Hulu, comedian Matt Matthews, Maya Hawke, she's starring in Wildcat, Spike Ferriston co-wrote Unfrosted with Jerry Seinfeld, that's out now on Netflix, we had Brent Smith of Shinedown, Waxahachie, Kevin Bacon, Pearl Jam, The English Beat, just an example of what you can get when you subscribe to the Kyle Meredith With podcast. And that's me, Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Thompson Twins co-founder Tom Bailey. We're going to be talking about the 40th anniversary of Into the Gap, as well as headlining this summer's Totally Tubular Festival, an 80s alternative music lover's dream that features co-headliner Thomas Dolby, along with Modern English, Men Without Hats, The Romantics, Bow Wow Wow, Tommy Two Tone, and The Plimsolls. Tom's going to take us back to the frantic album release schedule that the band enjoyed in the 80s, becoming designers of pop songs, and the critical response they occasionally faced. Tom's also going to remember 1994's The Stone, an LP that came with a different sound and name, Babel, and what it was like to re-enter the underground, and discuss rock's current lack of a social impact, the need for non-conformist outsider art, the band's many remixes, and new anniversary editions of their catalog. All that's and more. We're talking Into the Gap and the Totally Tubular Festival. It's Kyle Meredith with Tom Bailey.
Hello, Kyle. How you doing?
It is such a pleasure. I could run through the stuff talking about Thompson Twins and Babel. International Observer, of course. You had a great solo record a handful of years ago with Science Fiction. And now back on the road and coming to America for the first time in a few years with the Totally Tubular Festival. I should say a little ahead of time, but welcome back. It'll be great to have you back over here.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it because it has been too long. You know, I guess the pandemic was the big the block in everyone's schedules, wasn't it? And now we're slowly but surely catching up anyway.
Yeah, and it's a great lineup, too. I mean, Thomas Dolby, Modern English, Men Without Hats, Romantics, Bow Wow Wow, Tommy Two Tone, Plimsolls. And I'll go ahead and say that the final tour stop, at the moment at least, is Cincinnati, right up the road from me on the July 27th. So that's a nice group of people, it sounds like, to be a part of.
Yes, it is. It's a great lineup. And in fact, it's particularly good because Thomas Darby and myself have a long history. We've known each other for ages. He played on my second album, actually. But we've never, apart from one occasion when we shared a festival bill obscurely in England, we've never actually played on the same stage. And it's been a long time coming. And we've got all sorts of weird history together, but never actually just on a stage. So that's good.
There's no lack of good material between all of you all. But I guess a part of this is too, and kind of getting into the meat here, is a celebration of Into the Gap 40th anniversary.
That's right. I mean, first thing, who would have thought that, right? It simply doesn't occur to you when you're making records what you'll be thinking about them in 40 years' time. But I have to say, I'm very, very happy with that record. I always was, and it stood the test of time for me as well as for other people. I mean, some artists get bored with their work, I guess, but I haven't. It may have been helped by the fact that I took a long break from pop music. You know, I didn't perform any of the Thompson Twins material, but they tell me 27 years.
Is that right?
Yeah. So if you subtract that from the 40, it's actually only 13 years since so I'm playing tricks with my own mind here, but do you know what I mean? I did take a long break.
And I can get that, you know, because an artist, you want to push forward and you want to try new things. And you certainly have had this career, innovating career. Coming back around to that, is it a moment of making peace with those songs?
I guess there's an element of that. It's more actually a question of rediscovery. I always say that listening to my recorded works is like reading an old diary, because it just takes me back to where I was, who I was hanging out with, the ideas that we were discussing, the trends that were fashionable at the time. You know, those kind of things come rushing back to you, and because mentally you've left them behind. But that doesn't mean to say that they're bad. In fact, it's been a real pleasure, especially with some of the lesser known songs. I guess I'd left them behind totally for a long time, and so I was a little nervous about are they really up to scratch. And in fact, they're all good, so I so much enjoy playing them now.
Do you, since we're kind of thinking about it in that with those glasses on, do you what comes to mind with that era when you're thinking about that Into the Gap specifically? Because you guys, like, picking up so quickly from Quickstep and Sidekick. And I mean, the speed of working at that period, it just seemed, I don't know if frantic's the right word, but, you know, there was lots of releases in succession, right? You know, so how does one album start to stand out from the others?
Well, I mean, I guess that was the way things worked back in the day. We did have a kind of a cycle of writing, recording, touring, writing, recording, touring. And you basically did that until you collapse, you know, so that gives you three or four albums in a row. And in our case, you know, we did a couple of albums as the seven piece, or the bigger guitar bass group, which folded into the three piece that everybody now knows well. And from that point onwards, we had a very, very straight run of three albums more. And yeah, it stands out because you can trace the development of a songwriting team within us. You know, as soon as we got down to three people, my analysis was that we stopped having to write for a band that we were, and started becoming the designers of pop songs and pop recordings. And that changed everything. And it occurred simultaneously with the arrival of technology, the synthesizers, the drum machines, and the access to recording gear that we so much wanted. You know, so it revolutionized the way that I made music and the way I thought about making music. And of course, I wasn't the only person doing that. It was the style of the early 80s to be into synth pop.
Right, right. But that phrase, the designers of a pop song, I mean, of course, you all broke. I mean, you were doing it beforehand, but the singles and how they charted, I mean, they were obviously connecting in those sessions. What did that mean to be the designer of a pop song as opposed to just being a band? When you said that, the first thought that came to my mind was there's an old tale. I don't know how much weight it has in the truth, but Rivers Cuomo from Weezer would they said he took Nirvana's Nevermind and he like mathematically wrote it out to figure out why those songs were the way they were. So what like when you talk about being designers of a pop song, like what did that mean in that moment for you all? Like how you approached that writing?
Well, it's certainly true that you can study other people's work and benefit from it. But no, what I meant was that, for example, the first two albums had guitars all over them because, there were two guitarists and a bassist. Suddenly I said, okay, no more strings on. So the Quickstep and Sidekicks album had no guitars whatsoever, apart from, I think, three notes played by Monty Brown because he happened to be passing through the studio. And that for us was a kind of design decision. We're going to make a record without guitars. Couldn't have done that with the previous band because there were guitarists in there, but do you see what I mean? So it shifts the emphasis and it's a very liberating thing. And then suddenly you stop seeing drum kits as big pieces of equipment in the corner of the studio and start looking at tin cans and fire extinguishers and things you can just hit to make a sound. And then of course when the appropriate technology of sampling came along, then suddenly it blows the whole thing wide open and you look at making pop music in a new way with new sounds that people had never heard before.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Tom Bailey. Looking back on it, it seemed like there was, I mean, a lot of bands had this issue. There was a disconnect between what the critics thought and what the fans actually thought. And when you got the fans heralding you all and it's racing up the charts and everybody's loving that, and then you have these critics that are going, "Oh, it's okay." Did it feel like a disconnect back then in that way?
Not very much because the interesting critical platforms were always championing the new, the things that were bubbling up, the underground, and so, and quite rightly, and that's a very healthy thing. As soon as you become successful in the mainstream, so to speak, then they lose interest because it's no longer a banner they have to wave for anybody. It's doing its own job. And so you get into that situation, and fans too sometimes say, I used to love them when they weren't famous. And I think we all have we recognize that motive because we all have a little bit of that. I discovered it was very special. And then now everyone knows about it. It's not so interesting. But hey, that's something you have to live with as a pop group because by definition, you're asking for mainstream success and acceptance.
But then, when you look further down, and you get to the album "The Stone" that you all did as Babel, which by the 30th anniversary year for that one, like that's an interesting point too, because here you are, you changed the name with some, one of the couple of the same members, obviously. But what are you asking at that point? Are you asking to forget all the past because now we want to try? Because that was hard for some people to do. Which, but I want to say, just to preface that question, I think that record, The Stone, is a masterpiece, and I honestly mean that.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind. But strangely enough, and I'm going to sound very immodest, I kind of agree with you, actually. I think Hold Me Now, sorry, Into the Gap and The Stone are two records where, for some reason, it all just came together. There are no kind of bald patches. And that doesn't always happen. It certainly hasn't happened on all the other records, but those two are special. But talking about The Stone, we're jumping way forward now. And what happened was, I guess we signed a new record deal. MTV had become so powerful that it was all about videos, not about touring. And Alana just wanted to quit. She said, why do we have to go dragging around the world when we can just make videos? Because she was, that was her thing, making videos. She enjoyed it. She had a big creative input into that. And I guess I slightly resented that, but went along with it anyway, thinking, oh, maybe that's the way the world is now, And that's what led to the 27-year gap.
But man, for whatever reason, there is something special about that. I've heard that record dozens and dozens of times. Of course, I put it on again as I was thinking about this record. And just like there's, you know, with any artist that has longevity, you know, you probably, especially when you talk about decades, you get to a point where either you don't know what the next step is, or a lot of artists can't find that next step. A lot of artists can't find a new sound. Like, it is a different band, but it's almost striking how different it sounds as compared to everything else. Like, how did you all end up there?
We jumped back into the underground, you know. It's a bit like you going back into the basement here. We just said, let's go back to where it all started and see what we can discover and see what's happening in the underground now. And in fact, there was an enormous resurgence of psychedelic dance culture at that very time. Which we enjoyed and felt that it was also the latest version that we had something of a part in creating as well. So we felt very comfortable in that. And we just immersed ourselves in it. And it wasn't a hard thing to do. And just like you, we did it in our basement.
Love the basement's becoming a character today. That's I'll have to get me one of your posters behind me. Do you ever play any of those songs at all on your solo stuff?
Oh no, not it never even occurred to me, to be honest. Because actually, you're a bit of an unusual correspondent in a sense that you've exposed both those eras of music to yourself. And a lot of people don't do that. They're either fans of the Thompson Twins or of Babel. And I think in a way that's a sign of its success. It was different enough to capture a different audience or interest a different audience. But of course, the record company were far from pleased at the time.
Because, I'm sure they wanted you to sound like the Thompson Twins.
Yeah. And as Alana kept saying, you know, they thought they had Coca-Cola and we turned into some obscure homebrew.
That's good. Well, it's a good taste in homebrew. It's also like when I think of both of these records that we're talking about and the kind of the lineage of alternative music and what it's meant throughout the years, that you've been such a part of the fabric of that. And I was thinking, like, especially as we're talking about pop music and alternative music, because you rode that line. You had pop hits as a sort of an alternative group. Did you ever feel like you were writing outsider music that was making it mainstream?
Yeah, because we came from the outside. I mean, we were, you know, especially by the time it got to the three-piece, we were three scruffy orphans with no money and living in squats in South London. And, you know, we weren't part of any kind of music business institution. We were just scratching a living. And prior to that, we made two albums, but it was done scratching up and down the freeways in a small truck and playing every venue that would have us and kind of honing our craft. But I mean, I think there's a deeper point here, which is that back in the day, the big motivating factor, and I think it's a real sadness that this is now diminished so much. The big motivating factor was that rock and roll still seemed to be a thing that could change the world for the better. You know, it was a way of gathering people's attention and saying, we're not going to stand for this. We want a better world to live in. And so that kind of revolutionary ambition of rock and roll was stopped it just being a kind of selfish dilettante activity, you know, like a hobby. It was something that you had to do almost by moral obligation. And I think I came to the point after a couple of albums that weren't so successful thinking this would be better realized if more people were listening to it. And the way to get more people to listen to it is to write music that appeals to more people, you know, and you have those skills, why not use them? So it is weird. So you end up right on, you know, in the charts, as it were, carrying this kind of strangely liberational message that came from way, way outside the charts. And I think that has survived in my motivation ever since. You know? And it's very weird now that I'm going on stage with also this kind of added layer of nostalgia about it all, because rock and roll now is actually about celebrity and money. It's not about changing the world. So we've lost something really valuable, as you know, culturally. But people still remember it. So it means that there's still a chance things could change.
I mean, it still means something. And I'll echo that just because having grown up in the 80s, 90s, and in the time where it did, where it meant, as you're saying, something to hear it. It was very hard to swallow when that started going away. You know, people still make rock music, but it's not, you know, Live or Die, and it's not trying to change the world. But every now and then, you do still get a pop star who comes around that in their pop music, it feels like they're tapped into outsider arts, you know, whether it's, I mean, even like Olivia Rodrigo, that's one of my favorite pop stars right now. You know, she wears those influences on her sleeve, and it's like the young people are still finding that. And whatever you meant it to mean then feels like it's still resonating in that way.
Right. And it's interesting that you use the term outsider, because it's really important, I think, that this kind of activity isn't too conformist. It isn't schooled into all being the same. And we don't admire all the same technical abilities. You know, there has to be the kind of almost the folksy experimental mistake made that captures everyone's imagination, that you can't plan for. It just happens, you know, in that kind of cultural situation. So yeah, let's hear it for all those people who are still relentlessly having a go.
on the, you know, on the bigger side of that, what's the documentary that everyone's watching right now, The Greatest Night in Pop History or Music History, about the We Are the World nights?
Really? Yeah. I wasn't there for that one. So
right. But yeah, I haven't watched, but everyone tells me. I think of, like, you know, we're talking about coming from this one thing and how important it is. But even during that time, you would have the biggest, you know, pop stars in the world that were also trying to use that, you know, same muscle. And, you know, maybe with a little cheese factor thrown in. But
yeah, maybe the cheese was top heavy. And that's one of the things that made it a kind of... It was a marker in time and culture, wasn't it? It was difficult to do anything after Live Aid and all of that kind of stuff, because it was the biggest thing ever. And it had this intrinsic purpose, which everyone felt good about. And somehow you don't see that anymore. You know, the big stars are filling the stadium, and some of them are being real nice to their crews and bands and all the rest of it. And even, I guess, giving money to charities and all the rest of it. But you've lost that sense that the crowd is onto that.
And we'll be right back right after this. Welcome back. It's Kyle Meredith with Tom Bailey. It's not the first time you've toured Into the Gap, right? You did this in Australia a few years ago.
Yes, we did. We had one night in the UK and then a short tour of Australia, both of which were fantastic. The Australian tour was very soon after the pandemic, and people were very nervous about coming out. So we didn't have the full houses there that we should have had. But it went down so well that I think we'll just go back and do it again.
They won't even have noticed. That's the beauty of it. The deluxe editions, you know, that have been released, and I know what the box reissue that I think has also just got reissued, with those remixes and dub versions. Are there any of those that you tend to prefer?
No, I'm just happy that there are lots of different ones. You know, it was an interest of partly the time and place. A lot of people were doing that. I think I was one of the first, but not the first. And it was just out of an interest in Jamaican dub music, you know, where alternative versions of famous songs were, and especially instrumental versions, were being remixed. And so they went down well in the clubs. And, you know, even the more kind of pop-tastic we became, I still felt that we had to have one foot in the dance clubs. So, because that's where the marketplace in ideas had been so kind of nurturing for us. And it was a good thing to do. I would still do it now, given half a chance. In fact, I did some on the last solo album. I did some kind of alternative versions. So it's always a thing, isn't it? If you can do it, why not? And it's nice to have those alternative versions. But hey, I can't listen to them all endlessly. I forget which ones are which, to be honest. And it does become a little crazy and messy sometimes.
Well, of course, you mentioning it, Science Fiction was an excellent record as well. Do you think you've got another one of those that you want to do?
Yeah, well, I write all the time, and I've certainly got enough material. Because there is serious talk, well, I'm not even supposed to mention this, but the serious talk of, you know, big re-releases of Into the Gap for the 40th anniversary later on this year, I'm staying clear of releasing anything of my own. Maybe the year after. I mean, the other thing is that, of course, the record business has changed for people like me so much that it only makes sense to put out a record if I've got big touring plans as well. Because I'm doing it this year, it means I won't be doing it next year. So maybe the year after that, I don't know. I can't promise anything except that I get up every morning and make music.
Of course, once this 40th anniversary passes, it'll be the 40th anniversary of the next one. And, you know,
That's actually a problem because all of my peers from the 80s have all got 40th anniversary business this year.
Right.
It's nothing special to say, hey, 40th anniversary. You say, yeah, me too.
And then the 50th anniversary rolls around before you know it on one of those first records. And, you know, and the cycle begins again. Although that's got to be nice because when nothing is certain out here in the record business and nothing is certain about, as you say, it's not like, you know, you just churn out a new record and, you know, it's the same cash flow that you would have had. But to have that type of legacy where you can kind of go, you know what? 5 years, there's going to be another big round anniversary for one of these.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I mean, the legacy really counts in so many ways. And you remind me of the fact, you know, when I walk on stage, I'm walking on stage, hopefully well prepared and with a fantastic band. But I'm walking on stage with, you know, 10, 15 songs that everyone knows. And that makes an enormous difference. And you almost in a way get over the musical problems and start to engage with the emotional problems of being in front of a big crowd and what that means and what the potential payoff is. And that's the thing I'm always seeking out, you know, that connection. Otherwise, you know, I'm kind of over the fame and fortune thing, but I really like the emotional connection thing.
Sure. Why wouldn't you? I mean, what a great thing to have. What a thing to be blessed for, you know? That's
it's one of the great highs that human nature is rewarded with, you know, feeling good about each other.
Well, you have definitely produced the art that has made so many people feel good, myself included. I will say, as a kid of the 80s, it was Lay Your Hands on Me that I think was probably my introduction to you guys. And to this day will still be a high watermark of songs of music, you know, that feeling has never left me.
Well, I'm better make sure we're going to play that in America.
Totally Tubular Festival. That's happening again. We'll see you around here in July. Tom, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about it. Seriously, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Good talking to you.
My thanks to Tom Bailey. Totally Tubular Festival happening this summer, 40th anniversary of Into the Gap. Thanks to you for checking out the episode. Do hit that subscribe button. Again, you'll get 3 new interviews sent to you just like this every single week. New and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at Spotify, Apple Podcast, at NPR, WFPK.org, Consequence, YouTube for the video versions, or anywhere you get your podcasts from, you can subscribe to Kyle Meredith With. And please give a rating, leave a review as well while you're at it. After that, you can head over to WFPK.org, where I do a show Monday through Friday, starting at 6 p.m. Eastern. You get 4 hours of classics from the 80s and 90s. You get the best in new music. There are bonus interviews. Lots of music news as well. One of my recent shows featured some classics and favorites from Frankie Valli, Otis Redding, Iron and Wine, Fiona Apple, Counting Crows, Crowded House, The Raconteurs, Modern English, Blur, Liz Phair, REM, Rap Boys, Tyler Childers, Billie Holiday, Echo and the Bunnymen, Dolly Parton, The Chemical Brothers, Beck, and my interview with Sheryl Crow. Just an example of what you can hear every weeknight, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence says your music and film news. You can also find me on any of the social media sites. The address is always the same. It's at Kyle Meredith. So I do hope you like and follow along. That does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Have a good one.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.